KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm very excited to interview one of my fellows. Kevin Bankston is a senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation and is a colleague as a fellow at Stanford Law School Center for Internet Society, specializing in free speech and privacy law with a focus on government surveillance and internet privacy. And that's going to be the focus of our discussion today. Kevin has taken the lead in handling a couple of very high-profile cases that EFF has brought against both AT&T as well as the federal government involving spying and warrantless spying by the National Security Agency. These are lawsuits that should be of interest to any consumer who uses any form of communications, really, in the United States, because what these NSA spying cases about are literally just that. According to EFF's website, this is a massive program of illegal dragnet surveillance of domestic communications and communications records of millions of ordinary Americans since at least 2001. And we'll drill down on at least 2001 as much as is possible. On Hearsay Culture, of course, we have two primary focuses. The first is intellectual property law. The second is technology. Today, obviously, we'll be focusing on technology, but also focusing really on the power of the government to intercept communications as well as access information that consumers might believe or think should be kept private. One of the major questions here, of course, is not only whether AT&T and other entities should be cooperating with the government, but in fact, whether this program is something that actually works or should be there, and what kind of due process safeguard should exist in order for the government, if it's going to have access to these records, what hoops should it jump through. With Kevin's work and others at EFF, going back several years, we have a pretty interesting paper record of what this program is about, and we're going to be discussing it today with Kevin. Now, a couple of disclaimers on my end. First, I have made contributions, financial contributions, to EFF. It is an organization that I support, and so I wanted to put that disclaimer out there. Secondly, we will not have on the show today anyone representing the government or AT&T, although I may very well, hopefully, will be in the process of being able to have someone else on the show to discuss that perspective. But today we're going to be focusing on the work of the plaintiffs and EFF in this area. And lastly, and not insignificantly, we're going to be talking about two primary cases that are actually not closed. They're in the process of litigation as such. Kevin is appropriately limited by attorney-client privilege in what he can discuss. So this is going to be a very carefully crafted interview because I am not certainly seeking, nor does Kevin want to, violate the attorney-client privilege. It's not something I want to be involved with, and it's certainly not something that Kevin wants to be involved with. Having said that, a brief background on Kevin is in order. In addition to what I previously mentioned, he's also written law review articles in this area. He is lead counsel on these cases from 2003 to 2005. He was EFF's Equal Justice Works Bruce J. Ennis Fellow, studying the impact of post-9/11 anti-terrorism surveillance initiatives on online privacy and free expression. He was also, before joining EFF, he was the William J. Brennan First Amendment Fellow for the ACLU, litigating similar cases. He received his JD in 2001 from USC and his undergrad degree from the University of Texas at Austin. As a former litigator, I'm always very happy and very privileged, I feel, to have a busy litigator take time out of their busy schedule to join us on the show. And with that, I thank Kevin Bankston for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. Thanks for being here, Kevin.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's start right off. I've discussed a bit of your background, but I think for those people that may not be familiar with EFF, could you give us a brief overview of what EFF is?
Sure. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is a nonprofit legal organization primarily focused on litigation that focuses on civil liberties issues related to new technologies, and particularly free speech, privacy, and intellectual property issues related to the Internet. I myself personally focus almost solely on government surveillance issues, and so issues of NSA wiretapping, issues of law enforcement surveillance, such as when should the government be able to obtain your email from Gmail or Hotmail, or when should the government be able to track your cell phone. issues such as that. But that's only a small part of what EFF does. And we are based here in San Francisco and have been here for a while, although earlier in our history we were a more policy-oriented group based in Washington, D.C.
I should say you are joining us from your office in San Francisco, and thank you for that. On Hearsay Culture, we've had Fred von Lohmann of your organization on the show, as well as Jennifer Granick, who I worked for when she was the director of CIS. With respect to EFF, I think one issue or one question that listeners might have up front is how you're funded. How is EFF funded?
To put it glibly, we work for tips. We are primarily a member-supported organization supported by the donations of individual members, as well as a few grants here and there. But mostly we rely on our membership to keep us working.
Very good. With respect to your background, Kevin, I ask this question of virtually all of my guests, but was there an event or experience that triggered your interest in the areas in which you focus on as a litigator?
Sure. I started law school primarily interested in free speech and intellectual property issues related to the Internet, with a burning desire to work on those issues, and already quite aware of EFF and the work they did, and hoping that I could someday do something like what the folks at EFF do. Immediately after law school, I went to work at the National Office of the ACLU in New York on Internet-related free speech issues. That was a postgraduate fellowship. But my arrival in New York was quite inauspicious. I arrived in early September, and indeed September 11th was my second day on the job at ACLU, which, as you may know, its offices are in the financial district,
right,
of Manhattan. And so, you know, when you saw the video of people covered in ash sort of marching up the FDR trying to get out of Lower Manhattan, I was one of those people. Mm-hmm. And so it certainly burns me when folks claim that we don't take the terrorist threat seriously. I certainly take it seriously. I was there, and it was indeed a horrific day in our country's history. But mm-hmm. the other thing I observed there while I was doing my First Amendment work was the creation and passage of the Patriot Act, which was a very broad expansion of the government's surveillance authorities, not only in foreign intelligence investigations, but law enforcement as well. And watching my colleagues at the ACLU working on those privacy issues, I became quite interested in that. And so when my fellowship came to an end, and the people at EFF who I'd met through my ACLU job told me that they had another fellowship opening up at their office to deal exclusively with privacy issues, I jumped at the chance. Mm. And so although I was primarily a copyright kid, I've somehow evolved into a surveillance man. and I love the work that I do.
The you raise an interesting point, which I think is worth exploring in a little more detail up front, since you raised it, which is this notion that the work that EFF is doing in this area, we're going to get into the details in a moment, is somehow antithetical to law enforcement and indeed a national interest in preventing terrorism and bringing terrorists to justice. So perhaps exploring that a little bit further, how is the work that you're doing right now not antithetical to that? I don't mean it as a softball, but I think it's a concern that we have, especially as we get into a case where you're challenging the government's ability, in one sense, to gather what it believes is valuable information regarding terrorism.
Certainly. Our goal is not to tie the hands of government or to prevent it from effectively investigating terrorist threats. As I said, that's certainly a threat that I myself personally take quite seriously. However, we do think that it is important, indeed critical, that as the government pursues terrorists, it does so within the rule of law. We are a nation of laws, not of men. Men are imperfect, and granted too much power can do great evil. And therefore, our goal in our cases, whether against AT&T or the government itself, has always been simply to ensure that a court can rule on whether what the government is doing is legal, and in particular, whether or not it is consistent with our constitutional rights and with the Bill of Rights, one of our critical founding documents, because we do not think that we need to surrender our fundamental rights in the fight against terrorism, and indeed, we don't think we can surrender those rights consistent with the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't disappear just because a new threat has emerged. And so our main goal, although we think the spying program we're going to be discussing is flatly illegal and expect that a court would agree with us if it eventually reaches the merits, our main goal is simply just to ensure that the courts do have their say, and such that our country's anti-terrorism policies do not become the sole province of the executive wielding unchecked power.
As last precursor question before we get into the nuts and bolts of the actions you brought, as someone who's previously taught civil procedure, one of the first case I teach, in fact, second case I teach, is Hamdi v. Rumsfeld, the case that I'm sure you know well, and for listeners' benefit, is basically the case that established that citizens captured in the field of battle, in the case of Hamdi in Afghanistan, do have certain basic due process. Process rights, not the same rights as one would have in a district court in the United States, but at least due process rights in terms of the ability to have a fair hearing and to challenge the evidence and so forth. With respect to due process and something you've mentioned here, what is fundamentally the overarching due process concern that gives rise to your suits?
Well, I mean, due process directly doesn't have anything to do with our affirmative lawsuits,
right.
Although due process issues did indeed come up in our challenge to the immunity for AT&T and other telecom.
Right, right.
That cooperated with the NSA.
Mm-hmm.
And in essence, our biggest due process concern there, although we can talk more in detail about it later,
right.
Was that under this new immunity statute, if the Attorney General files a secret certification with the court claiming that the surveillance was legal or authorized by the president or did not happen, the court had to dismiss our case, and we had no ability to see what the Attorney General was claiming or what, if any, evidence he had marshaled to support his certifications, and therefore had no real ability to counter that certification, and we argued that that violated our plaintiff's due process rights.
The reason I raise it here up front as we get into the case is because I think it gives you, or may give the listener, a sense of the kinds of issues we're talking about here. We're talking about, and this is really the opening question, we're talking about domestic surveillance done by the National Security Agency. And that, by definition, sounds like this is, to use a loose term, but this is very, very secret activity. Activity, of course, that the government would rather the public not be aware of.
Indeed. And the main fight that we've had in our cases so far, now over 3 years since the program was first revealed, has been over to what extent the details of the program should remain secret, and whether or not we can safely litigate the legality of the program without inadvertently harming national security. But in terms of the critical rights at issue, I think we probably ought to start with the Fourth Amendment to our Bill of Rights.
Fair enough.
Which is, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, is the amendment that protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And requires that the government show probable cause to get a search warrant if it wants to search your person or your home or your papers or your effects. This was a response to the experience of the founders under the thumb of England, where agents of the king were authorized by so-called general warrants to essentially search for evidence of crimes against the crown wherever it might be found. And so based on these general authorizations, the agents of the king could bust into your house, and look through all your stuff without any kind of particular suspicion or any particular description of what they were looking for, and without any particular probable cause that you had committed a crime. And so the Fourth Amendment was a direct response to this experience of general warrants, which as we discuss this more, echo very much with the conduct of the NSA and its dragnet surveillance. But so the history of this issue really starts back in 1967, when in a couple of critical Supreme Court cases, known as Berger and Katz, the Supreme Court found that the Fourth Amendment doesn't just protect property or places, it protects people, and in particular their reasonable expectation of privacy. And in finding this, the court further found that eavesdropping, electronic eavesdropping on your phone conversations, is a Fourth Amendment search and seizure, such that a warrant is required. And indeed, they found that what we have come to colloquially call a super warrant was required, an even stricter warrant than usual, that had strict time limits, wiretapping could only be used for particularly serious crimes, and all other investigative techniques had to have been exhausted. And so these are requirements above and beyond a regular warrant that are required for wiretapping. Later in the 70s, in the wake of the Watergate scandal, the Senate created a special committee to investigate domestic intelligence activities that had occurred not only under the Nixon administration, but under prior administrations. And what that committee, the Church Committee, found was a frightening and sad history of widespread domestic spying, including wiretapping, in particular, a great deal of domestic spying for political purposes, spying against the political enemies of those in power. Perhaps the most famous example of this is the FBI's extensive investigations of wiretapping of and attempts to harm the reputation of Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
They also uncovered a couple of National Security Agency programs, Dragnet wiretapping programs, in fact, called Minaret and Shamrock, where the NSA, without any legal process at all, had for many, many years been receiving from Western Union copies of every telegram leaving and entering the country. And so in the face of these revelations, and in the face of the Supreme Court's holdings about the Fourth Amendment and wiretapping, Congress decided it was time to pass a law to strictly regulate when the executive could engage in surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes. They'd already passed a general wiretapping statute back in 1968, but that had explicitly carved out wiretapping done on the president's authority in national security cases. But they, once the Church Committee showed them the error of their ways, they decided to pass a new law in 1978 called FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which created a secret court in Washington, D.C., whose only job was to consider applications for surveillance in foreign intelligence cases. And a few key differences between the regular law enforcement wiretapping and this FISA wiretapping, The government didn't have to show probable cause that there was a crime happening, but they did have to show probable cause that their target was an agent of a foreign power, was working in the employ of a foreign government or a foreign organization. And also, worrisomely, unlike the regular law enforcement wiretapping, targets of FISA surveillance never receive any notice that they were wiretapped. Civil libertarians have never been huge fans of this FISA regime. We think that the Constitution requires criminal probable cause, and as well as eventual notice to targets. But regardless, FISA was the law. And in particular, Congress made very clear that FISA and the Wiretap Act that they'd previously passed were the exclusive means by which the government could engage in domestic surveillance. And this is important because the president, presidents before and presidents since, have claimed that they have some inherent power to authorize wiretapping as part of their commander-in-chief powers. But Congress made clear that to whatever extent the president had any authority in that area, it was reducing it to its lowest ebb and making clear that this statute was the exclusive regime for getting authorization to do domestic wiretapping.
We're talking with Kevin Bankston of the Electronic Frontier Foundation on hearsay culture. Please continue, Kevin. This is a fascinating history.
Fast forwarding to December 2005. Let's take a detour briefly to 2001, shortly after 9/11 and the passage of the Patriot Act. Shortly after 9/11, the Department of Justice pressed for a wide range of changes to both FISA and the Law Enforcement Wiretap Act and another privacy statute, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, all of which aimed at liberalizing the standards and allowing them to do more surveillance with less authorization and less notice and ability to get broader types of information with easier to get process. And so basically, October 2001 was the Department of Justice's opportunity to get whatever they thought they needed in terms of changes to the law to fight terrorism effectively. Civil libertarians were also not very happy with that act. However, it was the law, as was FISA. And so now we flash forward to 2005, December 15th. And in a bit of falling off my chair type news, The New York Times on its front page reported that since 9/11, and despite the fact that the government had succeeded in amending all the wiretap laws to the extent they said they needed to fight terrorism, the executive branch had been ignoring those laws, and in particular, ignoring the procedures of FISA and bypassing the FISA court to conduct domestic wiretapping without FISA court orders in violation of the law, based on the president's claim of his own inherent authority to wiretap as commander-in-chief. This was an incredible shock, particularly considering the government had already gotten all the changes to the law it said it needed. But apparently there was a widespread program of domestic wiretapping that ignored the FISA regime, and in doing so clearly violated the Fourth Amendment. Several courts had examined the FISA law and found that its procedures were essentially the minimum allowed or by the Fourth Amendment in the context of foreign intelligence. And so not only was the government blatantly violating the FISA law, but also the Fourth Amendment. Hmm. The president came out shortly after that story to defend that program and coined a phrase that didn't exist until they started doing damage control when this news came out, called the Terrorist Surveillance Program, or TSP. And the president admitted there was a terrorist surveillance program, but don't worry, it only narrowly targets the international communications of people linked to terrorism. Now, this gives the impression of, well, okay, they violated the law, they broke the law, and they're doing these wiretaps, but at least it's a small program, and it's only, you know, targeted at bad guys and only international communications, and doesn't really implicate the privacy of most Americans. And I think at that point, that's when most Americans shut off and stopped even thinking about the issue because, well, the president said it was very narrow. Hmm. But the New York Times knew better. They had held off on publishing some of the details about the program because the president had assured them that the program was legal. But as soon as they published their story, and practically every legal mind who knows these issues and that didn't work for the executive branch confirmed that this was quite illegal, and then faced with the president's very narrow admission, which they knew was essentially not true, they published another story on December 24th indicating that the program was much broader than the president had admitted, and that indeed the NSA, rather than narrowly targeting certain international communications, had obtained backdoor access to critical telecommunication switches across the country that carry not only international communications, but the domestic phone calls and emails of you, me, and everyone we know. Hmm. To surveillance experts such as myself and others, this was particularly startling in that it was almost an identical modus operandi to something called Echelon. This is a program of intelligence surveillance done by the NSA for decades in cooperation with Great Britain, whereby all of the radio traffic on the planet is sucked up and then chugged on by computers, which look for particular phone numbers or particular email addresses or particular words in the content of a message. Indeed, they could even do scanning of voice communications with voice recognition software. Essentially, a massive surveillance vacuum that sucked up everything and then used data mining to pick out what the NSA analysts would actually read or listen to. This was all done outside of the country. But now, this new FISA news, violation of FISA news, indicated that they had turned that program inward and attached it to the fiber optic network in our own country. Because as the New York Times reported, they were plugged in at the switches, sucking up everything, and then using sophisticated, purportedly sophisticated, data mining techniques to sort out what they wanted. And this is a real sea change from the way surveillance has always been done in this country and the way we think surveillance has to be done in this country to be consistent with the law. A shift from retail to wholesale. Under the retail regime, the government picks out its target, its particular target, and then wiretaps that person. Under a wholesale regime like Echelon or now this new domestic program, the government intercepts everybody and then decides who to target.
Is this analogous, Kevin, to your classic criminal procedure situation where the police just stop every single car and search it? That's one of your classic scenarios where you talk about probable cause. Is it a similar analogy or is this different?
Well, I mean, certainly the government, if we ever reach the merits of the case, would argue that their dragnet surveillance of everybody's communications, if they ever even admit that they're doing that, is analogous to a traffic stop like that, which is justified by a, I think, rather dangerous exception to the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement that is developed called the special needs doctrine, where to the extent the search is to further a special need of the government unrelated to law enforcement, that a warrant is not required. We look forward to litigating that issue if we ever do reach it. But regardless, I can't preview our arguments against an argument that the special needs doctrine applies here.
Of course.
But we certainly look forward to joining that battle if and when we get to it.
We are talking with Kevin Bankston, senior staff attorney of the Electronic Frontier Foundation here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that are familiar with Hearsay Culture, with KZSU, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station here at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I do hope that you consider making a donation, especially, and I understand that these are tough economic times. However, any amount, no matter how big or small, will certainly be helpful in keeping KZSU on the air and bringing you the diverse programming that has been its hallmark. Kevin, you ran through a fascinating history of this issue right up to the present day. I think a couple of questions drilling down on these particular actions are in order. Now, you have two active litigations, Hepting v. AT&T and Juul v. NSA. A couple of questions there before we even get to the status of those cases. As far as you know, is AT&T the only domestic carrier involved in this program, or is AT&T just the biggest?
AT&T is just the biggest. Numerous other carriers have been named in a number of news stories, particularly reporting by USA Today, as being involved in the program, while others have denied being involved, and some even described how they were approached to participate and refused, such as Quest. But the question of which carriers was a question that was very much on our mind as soon as this news of the broader program came out. And then on December 25th, 2005, Christmas Day, a bit of a Christmas present, we did get that news. The first carrier to be named was AT&T. A story in the LA Times described how AT&T was one of the cooperating phone companies, and that in addition to giving the government access to their switches, they were also giving the government access to their massive databases of historical records about who calls who and who emails who and when and for how long. And that was really the origin of our decision to sue AT&T. We had heard that other organizations were already going to be suing the government, and we figured that someone should also be enforcing the law against the carriers, because they play a really critical gatekeeper role. In the end, if the government wants to secretly wiretap everybody outside of the law, the only party with the power to say no and prevent that is the phone companies. And so we thought it was really important to sue AT&T, as opposed to the government, to ensure that it would follow the law, and by ensuring that it followed the law, ensuring that the government followed the law.
Now, the AT&T suit.
So as we were preparing that case...
Go on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It was really quite an amazing incident. But late in January 2006, as I was trying to finish our complaint in what would become Hepting v. AT&T, which was filed at the end of the month, a very nice older gentleman showed up at the door of EFF. This gentleman was named Mark Klein, and he was a recently retired AT&T technician. And he carried with him documents that he had obtained while working at the Folsom Street facility here in San Francisco of AT&T. And what those docs described was exactly what the New York Times had reported on. They described a switching operation whereby a splitter had been installed in that facility, diverting all of the internet traffic going through that facility, passing from AT&T's network to other networks and vice versa. All of that traffic, millions upon millions of ordinary Americans' domestic emails, IMs, web browsing activity, etc., were being diverted into a secret, secure room, access to which was only allowed for NSA-cleared personnel. And that secret room contained, according to the documents we had, which AT&T later authenticated, that room contained masses of very powerful data mining equipment that had the capability to scan all of that data for particular parties or particular content, and was attached to another smaller encrypted backbone such that that data could be sent to someone else, presumably a central NSA facility. And so what we had was direct whistleblower evidence of the architecture of the system that the New York Times had described. And this is one of the key bases of our suit against AT&T, or is this evidence from Mr. Mark Klein.
Now, what is the status of these two suits? I mean, Hepting v. AT&T and Juul v. NSA.
Well, our case against AT&T was going quite well. The government had argued that it should be dismissed based on something called the state secrets privilege, which is a privilege against the government disclosing evidence that could, if disclosed, harm national security. They made the rather extreme argument that, as opposed to the privilege protecting certain pieces of discrete evidence, that the privilege covered the entire subject matter of the program such that we could not even start litigating at all, and that the case should be dismissed at the outset. Our judge in San Francisco, Chief Judge of the District, Northern District of California, Judge Walker, in 2006, rejected that argument and said, "I'm sorry, government, but you have said so much about this program in your defense of it that you can't now claim that it's so secret that we can't attempt to litigate its legality, and that we will move forward and in a slow and secure discovery phase, we will ensure that the national security is not harmed. But at this initial stage, you can't get the case dismissed just on your bald assertion of secrecy." I think that scared some of the wrong people, or rather the right people.
Right.
The White House, soon after that, began an aggressive push in Congress to pass a law that would immunize AT&T and the other companies that had assisted the NSA. And I had to take off my litigator hat and put on my much more ill-fitting lobbyist hat in 2007-2008 as I spent an enormous amount of time in Washington, D.C., lobbying against this immunity. We thought that immunizing the phone companies would only guarantee that next time they were asked to break the law, they would do so again.
Right.
But unfortunately, President Bush had made an ultimatum that if Congress wanted to update the foreign intelligence laws, which they wanted to do, he would veto any bill that didn't include this immunity. And so ultimately, as part of a bill called the FISA Amendments Act in summer of 2008, that immunity did pass. And as I mentioned before, the gist of that was that if the Attorney General files a secret certification with the court that says, I've done a review and I've concluded that the surveillance was legal, or the president authorized it, mm-hmm. or it didn't happen, the case had to be dismissed. And so that certification was filed, and the government moved to dismiss that case, and we argued as best we could that that immunity law violated the Constitution, not only violated our plaintiff's due process rights, but also violated the separation of powers and essentially usurped the court's role in determining what's legal and what's not. And indeed, the Congress had violated separation of powers itself by delegating power to the Attorney General to essentially decide when the law applies. Ultimately, the court disagreed with our arguments and dismissed the Hepton case about a month and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
Although Judge Walker voiced, was obviously concerned by what he considered to be an unprecedented grant of immunity, he ultimately found it to be constitutional. We're appealing that decision, but in the meantime, soon after the immunity passed, we thought it was time to finally open a second front in our fight against the NSA spying,
mm-hmm.
And filed a new lawsuit directly against the government, against the NSA, against the DOJ, against the offices of the president and the attorney general and others, and also against several officers in their personal capacity, people who were critical in the formation and oversight, used loosely, of the program, such as Vice President Dick Cheney and former White House counsel and former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. And we filed that case back in September of last year, 2008. And the government's response there was essentially a rehash of things we've seen before. The government moved to dismiss once again based on the state secrets privilege, arguing once again that the entire subject matter of the program was such a secret that that our case had to be dismissed at the outset. But the government also made some new arguments that we hadn't seen made under the Bush administration, but that are now being made under the Obama administration. And this was to us quite shocking.
Right.
Which was, the government argued that the Wiretap Act and FISA and the other critical, exclusive federal surveillance law, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, that the government had sovereign immunity against any kind of claim under all three of these statutes, whether a damages claim or a claim for an injunction, which is, although we are seeking damages in this case, as we did in Hepton, our primary goal has always been to get an injunction to stop the surveillance, to get these secret rooms detached from the domestic network. But now you have the Obama administration arguing that this tripartite regime of incredibly strict and comprehensive surveillance laws that Congress passed actually gives no enforcement mechanism against the government at all, whether in seeking damages or an injunction. And this is an argument that even the Bush administration had never made.
Wow.
And is very frightening when the government says you have no rights in court to stop illegal surveillance, even if it is illegal.
Is it an argument that, based upon your read of the law, is it an argument that is ultimately meritless, and I know you you have a briefing on this issue, and that you've had oral argument a few weeks ago, and that the decision of the court has not yet been rendered. So I recognize again that this is a delicate area. But is it an argument that, in your view, is meritless, or is there some basis for the government to make such a broad claim?
It is baseless. Well, but to explain why, we have to break it down a bit. First, let's talk about the FISA law and whether they have sovereign immunity against the FISA civil cause of action. There is a civil cause of action provided for in FISA for suing those who conduct electronic surveillance, which is the term for what FISA regulates, under color of law. The government had argued in a previous case related to the NSA program in front of Judge Walker. He is the judge for all of the NSA-related cases. They've all been consolidated in front of him as part of the multi-district litigation process. In this case, Al-Haramain v. Bush, they had already argued that the government had sovereign immunity against damages claims under FISA. And Judge Walker had already rejected that argument, rejected it in that case. And so even as they were making this argument to the court, they knew and admitted, well, we know you ruled before that we don't have this, but we're just making this argument to preserve it on appeal.
Hmm. And for those that aren't litigators, what that means effectively is that if the argument is not made, then the argument can't be raised in as the appellate process goes forward. I'm sorry. Go ahead. So, yeah, just for the non-litigators in the audience.
God bless you all. and so, what was particularly new, though, was the government's argument that it was also immune from claims under the Wiretap Act and the ECPA, this Electronic Communications Privacy Act I keep talking about, but which I'll call ECPA from here on out. This was particularly notable because prior to the Patriot Act, it was clear that the government, the U.S. government, did not have immunity against claims under those statutes. In 2001, as part of Patriot, the law changed, and really not for the better. The Patriot Act took the government out of those civil causes of action in the Wiretap Act and the ECPA, such that anyone except the United States could be sued under them. And Congress created a new cause of action specific to the U.S. government for violations of those statutes. And the upshot was that they were making it much harder to sue the U.S. government for violations of those statutes. For example, instead of merely having to prove intentional violation of the law, plaintiffs would have to prove willful violation of the law, a higher standard. You wouldn't get a jury in these cases. You had to go through an onerous procedure whereby you filed a claim under what's called the Federal Tort Claims Act, with the agency you wanted to sue, and had to wait 6 months to see if they might try and settle with you before you sued, and a variety of other things that overall made it much harder to sue the government. But no one ever suggested that this statute made it impossible to sue the government. But that's exactly what the government is arguing now. It's arguing that because that provision also created some new causes of action against the U.S., for unauthorized disclosure of information they get during lawfully authorized surveillance, that somehow Congress intended that that's the only thing you can sue the government for. You can't sue the government for illegal surveillance, they argue. You can only sue the government when it conducts legal surveillance and then illegally leaks the stuff that it got through the surveillance. We think that argument is meritless on the plain language of the statute, which clearly reaches any willful violation of the Wiretap Act or ECPA. And it appears, although I don't want to predict anything, but it appears that Judge Walker agrees. We had oral argument on the government's motion to dismiss just a couple of weeks ago, and practically his only questions and his first questions and his most forceful questions to the government were about this argument. And he continually pressed the government, doesn't the plain language mean you're plainly wrong? And once again, the government admitted the weakness of its position. Tony Coppolino, the lawyer for the government, essentially said, well, Your Honor, we know this isn't our best argument, and we know this is a hard issue, but again, we want to preserve this argument for appeal. So not only do I think this argument is meritless, It appears the court may conclude that it's meritless, and it seems that the government itself, although it argued very forcefully in its brief that this was the only sensible reading of the law, even the government itself admits it's meritless.
We're talking to Kevin Bankston of the Electronic Frontier Foundation on KZSU-FM, Stanford, Hearsay Culture. Kevin, not to interrupt, we have about 10 minutes left, and there are a couple of questions I want to follow up on, again,
sure,
as you give the background. Several questions. First of all, you mentioned earlier that Quest was an example of an entity that said no. So my question ultimately is, do you have to be a customer of AT&T or the other entities that agreed to this program to be potentially scooped up? Or does it even go beyond the customers of the entities that agreed to cooperate with the government?
It reaches essentially every person who uses telecommunications in the U.S.
Okay.
And that is because, first off, even if you don't use AT&T, you are, as a regular matter, going to be communicating with people who do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that traffic, your communication with those AT&T customers, would be captured. However, there's also the issue of AT&T does have the largest fiber optic network in the country. And it, with the other major carriers, have agreements between themselves and with smaller carriers to help each other transmit the other's data, or in the parlance of the industry, to peer traffic for other carriers. And so the traffic of over a dozen other carriers routinely peers through the Folsom Street facility that we have documents regarding. And those documents indicate that there's another facility in Atlanta that's very similar. Mr. Klein heard from his colleagues at work about similar installations in San Diego, in Seattle, in Los Angeles. And on review of our expert, Scott Marcus, former chief internet technology advisor to the FCC, so a guy who knows what he's talking about, looking at the documents about the Folsom Street facility, he, in his expert opinion, believed that was consistent with an installation of 15 to 20 installations across the country that captured the vast majority of traffic on AT&T's network, which, because it peers traffic for other companies, represents a significant fraction of all of the traffic in the U.S., AT&T or non-AT&T.
Do we know, or has the government indicated whether this program has prevented any terrorist acts, or and otherwise has been successful, or are they basically saying we can't discuss it because it's all classified?
Well, defenders of the program over the years have, many times, given sort of boilerplate assertions of this is a critical tool in the fight to stop terrorism. It's one of the crown jewels of our intelligence operations. But that doesn't appear to be the case. You know, for a while, the only indication we had about the actual usefulness of the program came from sources within the FBI. And what the FBI said was the leads that were coming to them from the NSA program were essentially leading to costly dead ends, where they were expending their resources on these tips from the NSA program that would lead to an innocent school teacher, or in particular, the pizza delivery guy, the Pizza Hut, you know, places that people called a lot, such as the Pizza Hut. Indeed, so much so that the slang for the NSA tips around the FBI office was the Pizza Hut leads. So whenever new NSA leads would come in, they go, "Oh, great, more calls to Pizza Hut."
Wow.
This is consistent with what we know scientifically about data mining to try and find terrorists. There was, I'm not sure when, it was within the past year, the National Research Council, doing a study sponsored by the Department of Homeland Security and the National Science Foundation, released a extensive report on whether data mining to identify terrorists worked. And their ultimate conclusion was, and I quote, "Automated identification of terrorists through data mining is neither feasible as an objective nor desirable as a goal of technology development efforts."
Hmm.
And the upshot was that you're always going to get so many false positives, like, you know, Pizza Huts, that it's not actually effective. And this was further confirmed recently, just in the past couple of weeks. Something that was required by the FISA Amendments Act passed last summer was a report by the inspectors general of the DOJ and the NSA and other agencies involved in the NSA program. And although that report still included quotes from some of the heads of those agencies saying, oh, this has been a hugely helpful program, the conclusion of the inspectors general was that no one could identify any specific case where a lead from the NSA program assisted in the fight against terrorism.
I see.
The agents who were given the leads often complained that they led to dead ends or were given without enough context to make them useful. And that it simply had not been that useful a program, which, you know, a lot of people talk about this, well, we have to make trade-offs between our security and our liberty, but that argument holds no water if the security you're getting in return for, you know, sacrificing your most fundamental liberties isn't actually that helpful. And that's what it appears is the case with this program. No one can point to any success of this program, and indeed there are a lot of people in the government who are complaining about how it is not useful to them.
We're recording this show on Monday, August 3rd, Kevin, we have a couple of minutes left, and I do want to ask you, this is the classic crystal ball question. I hate it in practice when clients ask this question, you know, are you going to win? I'm not going to ask that question. I'll spare you that one. But I will ask you this crystal ball question. Projecting forward, let's assume happy ending for your clients, who I understand, by the way, that this is a quick question, are AT&T customers, is that correct?
Yes, our clients in the Hepton case are 4, and in the Jewel, the NSA case, are 5 ordinary Americans who use AT&T service.
Okay, so let's assume that you get the outcome that you want. What do you want to happen? I'm not specifically asking what your relief is in or what relief you're seeking in the case, but more broadly, what do you want to see occur, assuming that your cases are successful ultimately?
What I want to see is the dismantling of what I think is the technical infrastructure of tyranny. And that is the technical infrastructure that allows the executive branch of our government to, without checks, vacuum up the communications of you, me, and every other American. This is the architecture of tyranny that we have seen in other oppressive regimes. But when you compare this NSA program to, say, the technical capabilities of the Stasi in East Germany or of the KGB in Russia, I think the people who ran those intelligence agencies would be drooling with anticipation at getting their hands on something as comprehensive as this. A lot of people will ask, I don't have anything to hide. Why should I care? excuse me. And I have a couple of somewhat glib but essentially sincere responses to that. First off, if you have nothing to hide, let me install cameras throughout your house. You know, if you really have nothing to hide, let's just go for it. You know, and no one's going to agree to that, which, in, you know, means that they do have something to hide. Not that they're doing anything wrong, but they do believe they have something private, a zone of privacy, that people shouldn't be able to violate without some justification. But my other response to the sort of, I don't have anything to hide, I don't care if the NSA sees my, you know, me exchanging recipes with my aunt or whatever, is, hey, you big narcissist, it's not all about you. It's about preserving the necessary, how to put this, it's about preserving the conditions for a free society. It's about ensuring that the government does not have the ability, through its secret access to private communications, to distort the political process and to demonize or go after its political enemies in a way that allows those in power to stay in power. This is exactly the kind of conduct that we saw in the Nixon administration that Congress wanted to prevent when it passed FISA and these other comprehensive rules regulating government surveillance. And so even if you don't have anything to hide, certainly political dissidents and the political opponents of those who are currently in power do have much to hide, legitimately, not because they are criminals, but because they are opposed to those in power. And it is the preservation of that liberty, the preservation of our ability to have political disagreements without those in power squashing them, that is the most important thing to protect here. And so what we ultimately want is to dismantle this infrastructure, have the NSA detached from the domestic network, and return to a retail form of surveillance where when the government has a target, they can wiretap that person, but not to allow this sort of general warrant, analogous to what the king used to do, our founders, this general search through the networks for evildoers, which I do not think there could ever be an adequate system of checks and balances to ensure that that infrastructure was not abused.
Professor Paul Ohm from the University of Colorado was on the show last year discussing an article he wrote about the ability of ISPs, Internet Service Providers, to monitor all data coming through their network. And the fact is that, as he wrote, that technology didn't exist previously, but we're getting to that point. The flip side of the ability of the Internet to be a means of communication is that it can be a means of surveillance as well. Kevin, this has been a great conversation. I think we've covered a lot of ground very quickly. For those people that want to follow your work and EFF works generally, where can they go?
Absolutely. We are on the web at www.eff.org, where we regularly post updates on a wide variety of our work. At that site, you can subscribe to our email newsletter, The Effector, and if you like, you can become a member of EFF and help support our continuing work.
Kevin Bankston, Senior Staff Attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you, Kevin, for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and for educating the listeners on these very important lawsuits.
It was my pleasure.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests coming up on the show. We're short on time, so I'm just going to, rather than go through the list, simply say if you want to find out more about Hearsay Culture, you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get the schedule of upcoming guests and all previous shows. We're now in the 90s of recorded shows, I'm proud to say. You can always listen to the show not only on KZSU from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time, but also by getting it by podcast, either through hearsayculture.com, through Stanford Law School Center for Internet Society page in the iTunes store, or by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu and subscribing to the RSS feed. As always, I also welcome your feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it educational and interesting. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.